that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey. The journey towards deconstructing hell. Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This is a podcast mini-series based off a book by a similar title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, edited by Chad Ball and published by Sacrosage Press. I am Josh Patterson, your host, and this podcast is also, I should mention, in collaboration, kind of, with the Rethinking Faith podcast, which is the podcast that I host. And today with me, though, it's not all about me. We don't have to go listening to Rethinking Faith. You know, maybe that show sucks. I don't know. That's for you guys to decide. But today I do have another author joining me today who contributed to our book, Deconstructing Hell, and that is Bob Cornwell, who wrote chapter one, the introductory chapter, which there's a lot of pressure there, titled To Hell and Back, A History of Hell. Bob, how's it going?
I'm doing well then this evening.
Good, good. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I know I can extend my thanks, including Chad's voice here, and thanking you for contributing to this volume, but also for contributing some extra time outside of your writing to continue the conversation in regards to the chapter that you provided for the book. So thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. All right, well, so we do, I have some questions that I have enjoyed asking the other authors as I have gotten to know them, got to meet them, and have similar conversations to this. And so I kind of want to continue with those just to keep a little bit of, consistency between episodes. And so I guess for starters, before I get ahead of myself here, would you be willing to maybe just kind of introduce yourself to our listeners a little bit? Maybe they're not familiar with yourself or your work. Can you just kind of tell us who you are and what kind of things you find yourself doing?
So my name is Bob Cornwall. I am a retired or sort of retired Disciples of Christ pastor and author of a number of books and a blogger. Continue to preach and write and involved in interfaith work and ecumenical work and a lot of different other things. I have a PhD in theology, historical theology, which is kind of the origins of why I was asked to write the history chapter for the book. So that's kind of my forte. And then it's just an interest that I have in the subject, not just of hell, but more broadly in eschatology, which I'll give myself a plug here. My colleague Ron Allen and I recently published a book called Second Thoughts About the Second Coming, Understanding the End Times, Our Future, and Christian Hope, which was published in February by Westminster John Knox. So some of what I'm doing in this chapter has a broader context in which that book sort of fits into.
Cool. Well, so I have noted that book has come out, and perhaps that might be something we could discuss. Well, actually, how about this? If I don't scare you away from this interview, then perhaps we could discuss maybe coming on the Rethinking Faith podcast to discuss your book on eschatology, because that's, you know, I know that's something that especially, you know, not to get too deep into my story, but especially when I was still a pastor in college, you know, I kind of got introduced to eschatology through N.T. Wright's book, Surprised by Hope. And that's always been something that's been really interesting to me. So I would love to continue that conversation. Yeah. Awesome. Well, so just based off what you were talking, I'm interested just to see kind of, because, you know, you talked about having a PhD in historical theology. So I'm just interested, what came first? What was your first love, history or theology? Or like, maybe that's not a fair question. Like, how did they kind of play together?
I've always been interested in history. So since I was a little boy, and then theology, I would say, emerged over time, and then they became one and the same thing as I went into my career. And my PhD is in ecclesiology, high church Anglican ecclesiology, so it has nothing to do with eschatology. So, but the larger interest is there.
Awesome. All right. Well, so here's kind of one of those questions I've been asking everybody, and that's so when you first were approached by Chad and asked, "Hey, I'm doing this deconstructing hell thing. Would you be interested in writing a chapter?" What kind of made you agree? What was your motivation behind wanting to join a project such as this Deconstructing Hell book?
Well, when Chad approached me, it was with a very specific task, and that was to utilize my background in church history to write the historical foundation for the conversation. So it didn't take much to get me interested in that, because I know that that's not always a forte of everyone who'd be contributing to a volume. So it kind of hit me where I wanted to be. So anyway, why not? Writing it was a lot more difficult than agreeing to doing it.
Yeah, sure. I know you made like kind of a note in your conclusion, like, well, I never thought I'd be writing, you know, a history of hell kind of chapter.
Right.
But yeah, awesome. No, I think that's really cool. And I think to your point, oftentimes in these kind of conversations around hell, at least in my experience, the historical aspect is often kind of left out. And so I really appreciated your chapter and just being able to actually trace like, okay, what is the historical development of these ideas? How did they kind of come to be? Maybe what was the context that they kind of developed out of? So I really appreciated that about your chapter, because I do think that's often overlooked in these conversations on hell. So I appreciated that very much. But following that, just one more before we kind of jump into your chapter. I'm just curious, for you kind of growing up, or maybe your first experience with Christianity, I don't fully know your story. What was your experience of hell, kind of growing up to compared to where you are today?
Right. So I grew up in the Episcopal Church until I was in high school. So I didn't get a lot of hell in church. You know, it's there kind of in the creed a little bit, and might get touched on once in a while, but that was really not a major concern. When I was in high school, I got involved within a Pentecostal group, and that's where I kind of got in, not just to the whole concept of hell, but just a broader conversation about, you know, being saved and who's saved and whatnot. Of course, within that, there was a strong apocalyptic dimension, you know, so that Jesus is coming back soon, very soon, as Andre Crouch sang. And of course, Larry Norman wanted to remind us that we didn't want to be left behind. You can tell my age. So that was, you know, part of the conversation. So I was, you know, it was part of who I was. But, you know, it was funny when I got to seminary, and I think it was already there, I got introduced to conditionalism by Colin Brown, who was my theology professor. And it made sense. And it wasn't like, oh, I have to give up something that's deeply rooted. It just made sense. And I moved in that direction. And then over time, I leaned towards a more universalist perspective, which tells me that this whole idea of hell wasn't very deeply rooted in who I was. I mean, it was there because it was part of the conversation, but I never really focused on it. And so when it was time to give it up, you know, it was pretty easy.
Yeah, that that's kind of similar just to, I guess, my own story. And, you know, in so much that I kind of like grew up in like in a Methodist church early on, and hell was not mentioned much then. And then my parents discovered the wonders of early 2000s contemporary Christian music, and we moved to the Southern Baptist Church down the street. And that's kind of when hell became like less implicit to more like of an explicit kind of way of speaking, you know, where we would have like revivalist preachers come in and talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and say like, they were lucky, but you guys, not so much kind of thing. Right. So it was similar. But also for me, again, similar to you, when I first started questioning the doctrine of eternal conscious torment, it wasn't something that was so much deeply rooted in me. So it wasn't all that difficult. It was more so just like, when I look at God and think about God, this doesn't quite make sense to me. So I kind of fell into the conditional immortality position for a while, and then ultimately led to where I'm at now, which is some kind of heavily nuanced ultimate reconciliation, blah, 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 universalism kind of type thing. So it's always interesting just to kind of hear people's stories and just really see where they're coming from.
Right.
But yeah, so to kind of get to the more specific point of our conversation, which is your chapter, again, on the kind of the history of hell, the historic development of these ideas, in case listeners don't know, which hopefully they do, Christianity started out within Judaism. without Judaism, Christianity would not be a thing. And so what better place to start than within the you know, pages of early ancient Judaism. So what kind of images of hell or what are we seeing in regards to an afterlife or something like that within ancient Judaism?
So when we look at ancient Judaism, especially in the Old Testament record, it's there. We have this idea of Sheol, which we're not exactly sure what that is. It could mean a shadowy place where the dead for the dead, but the word can also refer to a grave. It's really not until you get to really the second century BCE where you get, and maybe a little bit before that, but of course we have Daniel there, and then the beginning of the apocalyptic that goes back even before Daniel to like First Enoch. And there you have a pretty strong sense of resurrection, of afterlife, of rewards and punishment. That's there, which you don't really see so much prior to that. I mean, there is, you know, you have that reference in First Samuel where, you know, Saul goes and asks the witch of Endor to raise Samuel, and Samuel comes like, "What are you doing, raising me from the dead? Why not, well, just leave me be?" So there is that sense of afterlife there, but it's but Samuel is in the is just in Sheol. He's in the in this kind of nether world. So that's really not developed. But by the time you get to the New Testament, you have a much more developed idea of an afterlife, of resurrection. Paul was a Pharisee. Pharisees had a strong sense of an afterlife, of resurrection. Jesus held similar, if not the same, views, and those translate into early Christianity. As far as hell, I mean, Sheol is not hell. Sheol, the equivalent of Sheol might be Hades, the Greek idea of Hades, but Hades is not hell. Hades is simply the place of the dead, and everyone goes to Hades, good or bad, everybody goes there. You might have different rooms, different places in Hades, but you all go to the same place. There's no like heavenly, and it's like the dead go underneath the earth, and that's the way it is. So that's Hades. But you have these kind of apocalyptic ideas that begin to develop, and they're present in the New Testament, but they're not really explicit. And I remember, you know, we have this the story in Luke, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. And what makes, I remember Colin saying that is metaphor, that's parable. And notice that Lazarus and the rich man are in the same place. There's just a chasm between them. So it's not like he's up, one's up there and one's down here. There's a big canyon that separates them. And of course, Lazarus is hanging out with Abraham, in the bosom of Abraham. So that's the kind of the foundation. It's really not until you get into the second, third, fourth centuries that you really begin to see a development of ideas about punishment, of eternal punishment or forms of punishment. But even there's not unanimity. You have Origen who speaks of this kind of restoration of all things. And at the most, what Origen would say is that there might be a time and place of punishment, of purging, purgatory, purging of things that are still hanging on, but ultimately evil cannot exist. And therefore, you can't have, when all things are done, when the restoration of all things, evil disappears. We don't disappear, but the evil that might have hold of us disappears. So you have that train of thought, but then you have this other train of thought that continues on this apocalyptic direction, and it gets pretty gruesome. These pictures are like in the Apocalypse of Peter, which I think is maybe third century. And there's just these depictions of punishment, of eternal punishment, you know, that would reflect what it was that you had done, that the nature of your sin, you got the benefit of that as your eternal punishment. So, and it's pretty gruesome kind of stuff. So there's that is very prominent. But you have these two streams that are paralleling each other and developing over time. And then they get developed more fully, more theologically, especially with Augustine, who kind of lays the foundations for the idea of hell. And part of this has to do, and what I tried to do, I'm the historical piece, so I tried to offer as fair a perspective as possible, not so much critiquing a position as laying it out so that people, as it got developed in the book, you have a context and a foundation for those other conversations. But we can move all further into the book, but into the chapter, but that's kind of the foundation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you, for what it's worth, I think personally that you kind of achieved that goal then of trying to offer kind of this history without critiquing. The chapter feels very even keeled. You don't really kind of give your own perspective into like last sentence of the last paragraph in the last, you know, the end of the chapter kind of thing. So I think you accomplished that well. And so just kind of walking back to try to hit some key points throughout everything that you just said. One of them that I think is really interesting, and you kind of make this point early on in the chapter when you're talking about the afterlife in ancient Judaism, is that essentially you say that, like, immortality, in your words, immortality is not innate, as in an immortal soul, but essentially rather immortality is a gift from God, which I think is a really interesting concept, because I kind of remember learning that for the first time when conditional immortality was offered to me as in, you know, a differing perspective. And so I kind of thought that was really interesting. And maybe wanted to see if you had any more thoughts on that, because I think that's something, you know, ultimately a lot of times within at least the kind of Christian tradition I grew up in, I just assumed that, like, everybody was immortal. Like, that's kind of what we're taught. So, but it doesn't seem to appear that way, at least within ancient Jewish tradition. So I'm just interested in any thoughts you might have there.
Right. So until there's really an interaction with Greek thought, and that's not post New Testament. That's even in the early in Hellenistic period, which would be especially Daniel and Enoch. You have the beginnings of this idea of an immortal soul that begins to impregnate or infiltrate what had traditionally been the idea that, you know, whatever immortality we might have is a gift of God. It's related to God. God can give breath and God takes away breath, but we're not immortal in and of ourselves. And so you really can't have eternal punishment without an eternal soul. You have to have with the eternal, the idea of an eternal soul gave the opportunity for development of an idea that post-death, something happens to you. So with conditionalism, which makes a lot of sense, especially when we go back to the Old Testament, when you die, unless God continues you on, right? But if you have an immortal soul, you continue on whether you like it or not. So the question then is, where do you go? And one of the things I try to do in the chapter is raise the question, at least for thinking, for I think majority of the people who, including myself, who wrote chapters, we start with God's love, right? But the idea of hell develops as a sense of the need for justice, especially since, you know, in Deuteronomy it says that you know, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Okay, so I'm not supposed to take vengeance. Who's going to do it for me? And so that's where you begin to think in terms of justice as being part of the equation, which I think, you know, in some of the conversations in the book, maybe justice doesn't get quite as much attention. So I wanted to put it there, especially at the end, in my thoughts there. And we'll get there in a moment. But I think that those are, you have the immortal soul develop, and then you have to have the question of, well, does everybody, you know, make it or not? And what happens to those who are less than righteous?
Like, yeah, me. And myself included. and I think, I love that point, and you bring it up early on, this point of justice, and kind of like, it seems that belief in punishment, kind of like a quote that you offer here from Alan Bernstein, is that, like, belief in punishment after death becomes necessary when no sign of restoration is visible in life, right? And then kind of later towards the end of the chapter, like you mentioned, you bring up this kind of need for justice, and you actually go a little bit deeper and say, like, you know, for someone like, you know, speaking as you're like, for someone as myself, who's like, you know, I'm white, I'm educated, middle class, this kind of like need for justice might not be as apparent, readily apparent.
Right.
However, when I think of those on the margins, that kind of justice is almost like, oh, like of course. And so I think that's like a really interesting and helpful point that often I know myself I can overlook because I get so hung up in the weeds of like, well, that doesn't sound like a loving God and blah, blah, blah. But also I don't have constant oppression in my life where I'm like, no, I need some kind of theological explanation as to why, like me as a, you know, I was going to say godly person. That's not quite the right word. I'm, you know, like a part of the God's family. Why is there still suffering kind of thing?
Right.
So, yeah,
I remember it's not part of the chapter, but I remember a question asked of the local rabbi who's very liberal and was asked, do you believe in hell? And he goes, well, of course. How else do I deal with the Holocaust? I mean, you know, and when it comes down to that, you know, I mean, I don't think that my rabbi friend was consigning lots and lots of people to hell, but there had to be some sense of justice for a person like Hitler or Goring or Himmler or Eichmann, the embodiments of evil. Something has to happen to them. And that's why I think, you know, in terms of the longer term in my own journey, I always, even though I lean towards universalism, I'm always reminded that it's easy for me, maybe not so easy for another.
Yeah, that's such a, I think, a helpful and an important point and perspective story to kind of bring into the conversation that can often get overlooked, as you have mentioned.
Right.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't want to just kind of pass on from that, like, oh, but kind of if we were to continue the conversation within your chapter, you, right. As you've mentioned, you've gotten to like next, like the concept, okay, what happens in the New Testament? You know, is there eternal punishment with the New Testament? And specifically, I'm kind of interested here on Paul, because a lot of the times, especially within kind of the evangelical semi-reformed upbringing that I had, Paul was like the man, right? Like sometimes Paul's words are held higher than Jesus's words kind of thing.
Right.
And so I'm interested in your thoughts on Paul. Did Paul appear to believe in eternal conscious torment? Or where do you see his thoughts going?
So Paul isn't really clear. I mean, it's not a major issue for Paul. He doesn't spend a lot of time with it. He's not trying to go preach to people and saying, you know, if you don't accept Jesus, you're going to hell. That's not his message. At points, he kind of gives a sense of a leaning towards a universal restoration, a restoration of all things. But the wages of sin is death. He doesn't say wages of sin is death, and then you get judgment, and then you're going to go to hell. It's wages of sin is death, which is sounds like conditionalism, right? So my sense is that Paul has a strong sense of resurrection and spiritual body. There is words of judgment, but Paul, it's not a major issue for him, and really doesn't. I mean, you see that more, and maybe in 2 Peter. Maybe in Jude, but not really in Paul. It's not a, I mean, it's there maybe. I mean, you can, if you want to, you can create a theology of hell from Paul if you work really hard at it. But you have to start somewhere else and then fit Paul into a larger framework that, you know, Paul wasn't working on. Because I don't think it was an issue for him. At least it doesn't appear to be.
Yeah, it seems it definitely to be like a minor kind of conversation for Paul. He seemed to be, I mean, at least in my reading and understanding, Paul seems to be a lot more interested in kind of things that are much more current and relevant, such as the lives we're living actively, you know, presently.
I mean, he does have a strong apocalyptic dimension.
Oh, yeah.
He believes Jesus is coming back soon to bring everything into its fullness, restoring all things. But as far as what happens to people after death and whether they get judged and sent to heaven or hell, it's really not strongly present there.
Yeah, right on. Well, so if we talk about Paul, then, you know, we can't help but to ask the Jesus question, the good Sunday school question. Within the pages of the New Testament, you know, sometimes at least was told to me that, like, well, nobody talks more about hell than Jesus in the New Testament. Do you have any thoughts regarding Jesus's kind of conception of eternal conscious torment?
So Jesus talks about judgment, Matthew 25, you know, liberals love that one to some degree, as long as they see them themselves as, we liberals like to be see ourselves as sheep and not goats. But we kind of take that metaphorically. And so Jesus talks about weeping and gnashing of teeth and things like that. But again, we're not sure what he means by that. I mean, we know what he means metaphorically, but does he have a sense that this is, you know, a very developed idea of hell that gets developed later on? And I don't, because we don't see that idea prominent, like of an immortal soul and things like that. They're not there to work with. There's more just judgment and you know, fire and things like that, which easily moves towards conditionalism.
Yeah, that's, I mean, especially too, like, at least within my understanding, when it comes to Jesus being quoted using like the word hell in our English translations, if I'm correct, most of the time Jesus is using the word Gehenna, right? That gets translated as hell. And you make a point earlier on in your chapter, how like the Greek term, you say, while the Greek term Gehenna, Hebrew Gehinnom, or the Valley of Hinnom, is eventually identified as hell, it's not the equivalent of Hades or Sheol, which we've talked about earlier.
It's a place where things get burned up.
Yeah.
And the fires are always ongoing. But the question is, when you throw something into the fire, do they burn up or not? And that's the, now, if you have an immortal soul with an immortal body, which Augustine sort of figured out how the how you can have a resurrected body that won't burn. It can suffer, but not burn. But it takes to, we get to Augustine really to have that idea fully developed. But I mean, it's the concepts already emerging before him, but he puts it together in a little bit more explicit terms. So no, my sense is that hell, Hades are not the same thing as Gehenna. And Gehenna is a place of fire, it's a garbage pit. But it also earlier had been the place of human sacrifices, fire burning sacrifices to Moloch. So that's kind of where it emerges. And then it's this idea of the garbage pit that always has fire going, emerges over time. And we have to also understand, since I'm not a biblically literalist in all of its forms, that each of the Gospels sort of understand this and lay things out differently. So we don't have Jesus' exact words, even if they're in red, they're not necessarily Jesus's words. There are the words that we give to Jesus. I think many of them, if not most of them, probably go back to Jesus, but we don't have the exact words, even when they're in red.
Yeah,
that's why I don't like a red letter Bible, but that's another.
That's... Well, there we go. That's a good critique of the red letter Bible there. Because it's not like we have, you know, some kind of like, you know, magic video recording footage of, Jesus sitting down, you know, and delivering the Olivet discourse, like, yeah. So, yeah, right. There's always, Anyway, so kind of moving on from there. So we like talked somewhat about, well, actually, you know what? I want to do one more thing. Cause you did plug your book on Revelation. And I think Revelation is also a spot where a lot of people turn for some kind of view of eternal conscious torment. So I'm interested, do you see eternal conscious torment within the pages of Revelation at all?
It's possible. But when we're working with Revelation, and I'm not an expert in apocalyptic literature by any means, but when we're dealing with that kind of literature, they're so full of allegory and metaphor that to develop a strict definition of hell from Revelation is really difficult. What Revelation does do is give a sense that the people who are being persecuted, that God will take vengeance on their persecutors. And so there's that. And then there's the voice of the martyrs that is present, which you also find in Daniel. But to build a theology of hell around Revelation is really problematic. So could you? Yes. Is it there? Revelation is really hard to interpret. So I would say that we have to be careful about utilizing it for that purpose. Because I don't know that that's the purpose, other than it's encouraging people that God will take care of them and they're those that the enemy, which isn't necessarily people, will be taken care of. They will face judgment. They'll be thrown into the pit of the lake of fire. But even there, it's kind of like they get thrown in the lake of fire and like they disappear. So, you know, they're not like, I'm hot kind of thing.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I guess like one thing, and you mentioned this, and I too am no expert on apocalyptic literature, but that was always something for me that I try to keep in mind when reading something like Revelation, because the temptation is there, and maybe it's my like, you know, Southern Baptist evangelical upbringing kind of trying to show itself again. But there is kind of this temptation to take the book of Revelation and, you know, map it onto current day events or try to say like, oh, well, this is talking, obviously this is literal, you know, fire and brimstone kind of thing. And then often forget like, hey, there's this whole genre called apocalyptic literature that's trying to do very specific things by using, you know, extreme language in the same way that we might say like, oh, it's raining cats and dogs right now. It's not obviously raining cats and dogs, but you and I know that because it's a part of our culture. It's a part of the way we speak. Whereas maybe for like some of the readers, you know, early readers or even, you know, the author of Revelation, they would know like, oh, apocalyptic literature is a way of speaking and trying to communicate a more broad idea. That is still true. It's still a true idea. It matters, but it might not be the same as, oh, there's actually cats and dogs falling from the sky.
Now, when you move further along from Revelation into other apocalyptic, like the apocalypse of Peter and the apocalypse of Paul, then you get some pretty literal kinds of torment that's present. But then you have to understand that by the time that is being written, you have more the immortal soul as part been plugged into the conversation in ways that maybe wasn't with Revelation in the same way.
Yeah. And so these kind of like these apocalypses that you just mentioned, if I were to pick up my Bible right now and open it, I would not find them in there. So maybe for people who are not quite familiar with this kind of like, you know, literature that we find from outside of like our specific canonical text, where are these writings coming from? Like, what is this stuff you're referencing and why should I care about it? Kind of thing.
Well, I mean, you know, early Christianity produced all kinds of literature, and apocalypses, there are many apocalypses that emerge, really in this, from the second to the fifth centuries and beyond. So these ideas begin to percolate, and as early Christians are experiencing at first persecution, so the apocalypse of Peter talks more about what's going to happen to those who persecute Christians, and other Christians, and not just apocalypse. I mean, you see that in Cyprian of Carthage in the third century. So you find that what's interesting is we go to the apocalypse of Paul, which is like a fourth or fifth century document. Now it's not the persecutors who are facing hell and punishment. It's the heretics. So you move to the ones, you move from the persecutors to those who are heretics or that are corrupt, who commit ecclesial crimes and those kinds of things. Those emerge over time, and they kind of emerge out of a similar kind of idea that you go back to First Enoch, Daniel, and Revelation. But apocalypses keep on getting written, and they get more and more gruesome, really, as they go along. If you find Revelation to be a little bit stomach-turning at times, don't read the Apocalypse of Peter, because it will really turn your stomach. But that's out there. You can find it. Just Google the Apocalypse of Peter, and you'll find it online. Because they've discovered all kinds of documents, you know, that emerged over time.
Yeah, and so like the two mentioned apocalypse of Peter and the apocalypse of Paul. From like a scholarly consensus, I'm assuming that neither one of those apocalypses are actually believed to be written by those individuals. Maybe I'm wrong, but like what's Yeah, this is yeah, people I mean, penning as if they were Peter or Paul.
Right. So, I mean, you know, we moderns if you purchased one of my books, you would assume that I wrote the book, right? But names were attached to documents that weren't necessarily written by those persons. That doesn't make that... Because we find that in the Bible. So it doesn't make them fraudulent. It's just a way of attaching names to documents that was appropriate in the time and place. There's the story of Paul and Thecla. There's all of these stories that emerge over time that talk about the apostles, that talk about Paul. And, you know, some of them are really informative and have value, but they weren't written by those persons. They probably were written 100, 200, 300 years later. I mean, the Apocalypse of Paul dates probably to the 5th century, 4th or 5th century. Apocalypse of Peter, maybe the 2nd or 3rd, maybe 4th, you know, so it's early. It's before Constantine. One's before Constantine and the other one's after Constantine. So you can kind of date it that way.
Yeah, I love that you point out that it's not necessarily like these authors are trying to like fool you or something like that, but rather it's like this ongoing tradition, almost like, well, this is written in the spirit of Paul or maybe, I don't know, this metaphor might suck, but maybe it's like, if I really like the band... I don't know, August Burns Red. I really like August Burns Red. I'm going to write a song in the spirit of August Burns Red that sounds like them, that encapsulates what they're doing, but also it's Josh Patterson, who is not August Burns Red. kind of thing.
And yeah. you can write in the name of Paul or Peter or anybody else and not even have anything close to what one of those persons believed or wrote, because I don't think that the Apocalypse of Paul reflects at all Paul's theology. So, you know, it's one of those things where his name is out there. It's important. It's It has authority, and so you write something. So the Apocalypse of Bob Cornwell doesn't carry the same weight as the Apocalypse of Paul.
So maybe a better metaphor would then be, instead of trying to write an album in the spirit of August Burns Red, and I would just write my own album and then say, oh, August Burns Red made that. Because every, you know, people know that. They just don't know me.
Kind of thing. Yeah,
that's awesome. Kind of the way it works. Cool. All right, well, let's kind of move along here to some early kind of understandings within Christianity. So you reference two people who I really enjoy, Origen and Gregory of Nyssa. And then also you kind of comparing them with St. Augustine, who kind of really becomes like probably the biggest influence within Western Christianity and theology. Right. Can you just kind of give us a little bit about that kind
so
of?
So Origen, of course, is at the turn of the third century, late second, early third, mid third century. He is a fully embrace Platonic thinking. He's a teacher in Alexandria. And he has this idea of the restoration of all things that he roots in scripture. I mean, he's really the first true biblical scholar. And so he's working with that, with these ideas. And so he finds these things, and his vision is that ultimately evil must perish, and therefore all things will be restored. He didn't say for sure, but he thought that perhaps that would even apply to Satan, which is what got him in trouble later on. So he has this idea of the possibility of the restoration of all things, which has the possibilities of a universalist idea. He did have an idea of purgation, so that so when you have these references to fire and judgment, that if there's sin that or evil that has hold of you, you may need to go through purging, which may include suffering, but it's not permanent, it's temporary. And so that idea is there. Gregory picks up on some of that. He's not the only one, but Gregory and others that follow more an Eastern trajectory develop those ideas. And they continue on because Gregory, where Origen gets in trouble, not when he was alive, but later on in the sixth century, Gregory never gets in trouble. Gregory's thinking is acceptable. And so that idea of the restoration of all things continues on, especially in the East. Whereas in the West, you have a stronger sense of judgment that develops that's already being done. You see this in Cyprian. It's interesting if you think in terms of the people who really are developing these ideas, they're Tertullian, Cyprian, and Augustine. And they all have, they're all from North Africa. They're Latin-speaking, thinking theologians and church leaders, but they all have a connection with North Africa. And so you kind of see that trajectory that leads to Augustine. Augustine formulates things and gives some definition, especially the question of what happens, how can a body burn, suffer? And so we all are resurrected, some to heaven and some to judgment and then to hell. And so we're given a spiritual body that can therefore suffer. So we become embodied. We're not disembodied souls. We become embodied souls in the resurrection, and therefore we can therefore suffer torment and judgment. And that idea continues on, especially in the West, until present. I mean, we're all kind of heirs of Augustine, whether we like it or not. I know a lot of people don't, especially open relational folks, don't like Augustine, but you know, you got to deal with him. He's there.
Yeah, no, I think for sure, to your point, I know Augustine becomes like an easy kind of like target of critique, but also to Augustine's credit, like the dude was influential, like deeply so. And I think kind of one thing that my buddy Trip Fuller, I think does a really good job when trying to address someone like Augustine, who's like, probably there's a lot of stuff I don't agree with. He still tries to recognize and say like, okay, well, like put Augustine in his context and try to figure out what was Augustine trying to accomplish within his context, and like try to see the beauty in what Augustine might have been doing. Right. And then also say, okay, well, so now Augustine maybe said some silly stuff that I don't like, you know, maybe I don't think original sin is, you know, connected to semen or something like that. Right. But how can I inherit this tradition in a way that is both faithful, but also moves us forward into today? Right. And so I kind of love how Tripp talks about that. And so I want to give Augustine some credit, you know, where credit is due, as like right. you said, we like to make fun of him. But also too, I guess I want to ask a quick question. Do you think, would it be too generalized to say, based off what you're saying, that this more like restorative understanding of justice tends to be a more Eastern idea, whereas here in the West we have this more like retributive kind of understanding? Does that seem to more or less how it plays out?
I mean, you know, there's, you can find both ideas in both streams, but I think that the idea of restoration is much more prominent in the East than it is in the West. And, you know, what's interesting is we're now discovering that, you know, it's like people are discovering Eastern Orthodoxy and finding, oh, you know, Origen, Gregory, these guys have a lot to offer, Bulgakov, you know, and so we're starting to engage with people that we hadn't thought about, who didn't have the same conversations that the churches we're having in the West, especially, you know, after the Great Schism in the 11th century. You know, after that, there's really not a lot of conversation going on between the two. And, you know, and so that kind of leads, my thinking is that, you know, in the East, we have the trajectory from Gregory to Maximus to Gregory Palamas. You keep on going forward. You have a different, you have one tradition going that direction. And then you've got the maybe a more of a Augustinian trajectory that leads to Aquinas, and then to the reformers, and onward from there.
Yeah, I know it just experientially for me, kind of finding out that there was this whole other tradition. You know, like I wasn't taught about the Great Schism. You know, and listeners, that's like when the Western Church and the Eastern Church both like excommunicated each other, basically. It's more complex than that, but that's the gist of it. I wasn't aware of these kind of things. And so once you know, finding Eastern Orthodoxy was like really helpful for me, because then I was like, whoa, this Christian tradition is so much bigger, so much more beautiful, so much more diverse than I grew up thinking it was or being taught that it was. And so I love that you bring that into the chapter, but also just into this conversation that like, yeah, hey, there's a whole bunch of these, you know, Eastern Orthodox people, and probably we shouldn't just say they're all wrong.
Yeah, no, they may be right.
Right.
They are right in a lot of things.
Yeah.
You know, so you have this kind of two different trajectories. And from Augustine, we really meet, he's the kind of the linchpin from early Christianity to medieval Christianity. So when you move into that, you know, the key figure there, well, much of what we think of as hell is Dante. So, and where did Dante get his stuff? Kind of like the Apocalypse of Paul and the Apocalypse of Peter, you know, not from Augustine, but he got it from elsewhere. But what's in it, and I mentioned it in the book, in the chapter, but, you know, Aquinas has this idea of the five levels of Hades. So you have at the very basic level, you've got the place of no return. Those are the people who are irredeemable, you know, and they're going to suffer for eternity. They're at the bottom of this. You can kind of think of in terms of a cavern, and then above them is the infants who die, children who die in infancy, and they're in limbo. They're not suffering. They just don't have any vision of God. They're just kind of there, and then it kind of goes up until you get to the saints the Old Testament saints. And according to Aquinas, those are the ones that Jesus visited and freed. But below them, in the second level from the top, are those in purgatory. And purgatory is this, you see this in Origen and Gregory and Augustine. There's this idea of a need for purgation. And Aquinas kind of lays it out pretty in clear terminology. And that becomes the kind of the foundational understanding of what happens. So there's, even if you're not able to pass muster on the first level, you know, you still have the opportunity if you're in purgatory. And so the key is to be relieved of that. So we can pray for the dead. We can pray and we can do what we need to do to relieve them, release them from purgatory. But what happens with the reformers is they get rid of purgatory. They take on everything else, but they get rid of purgatory. Now, there's a reason for that, and that has to do with the corruption, indulgences. But in getting rid of that, you have only two options, heaven or hell. There's no in between, and which is kind of unfortunate, I think. I mean, in one sense, that if you're going to have an idea of hell, of like Aquinas would have it, if you're, you know, Hitler and Stalin, you know, they get the bottom level because they're irredeemable, but everybody else has the possibility of being of redemption, even after death, which is what Origen believed and what Aquinas believed. But the reformers, Luther and Calvin and others, got rid of that. And Protestants don't have purgatory. And maybe that's a problem. Maybe more of a problem than hell. Getting rid of hell was getting rid of purgatory. Now, that's a whole nother conversation. It wasn't part of the larger conversation in the book, but it's interesting how we are the heirs of that choice, which left us with an either or kind of thing.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I remember growing up being taught that, like, oh, well, like purgatory, that's just like some silly bullshit that the Catholics made up, you know, for what, you know, that's literally like how it was taught to me.
Right.
But as I continued to like study on this topic and read, I was finding people talking about something, you know, in regards to like a more restorative form of justice that looked and sounded like purgatory. And I was like, so why was this so bad again? kind of right. thing. It seemed helpful to me. Yeah. And so like you said, you kind of get into this, you know, with the reformers, they kind of ditch it and it's this either or. And so maybe they threw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was corrupted and used inappropriately. But if we take it back to its origins with Origen, then we have at least the possibility of thinking about that. I don't know that we would want to re-embrace it, but it does address the question of justice and whether or not there are things that need to be dealt with. That judgment is part of the conversation. We do know that judgment is part of the biblical story. I mean, you know, I mean, Matthew 25 is a story of judgment, a parable of judgment. So it's there. I don't think you can dispense with that. The question is, what do you do with that? And that's been the dilemma. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I say at the end of the chapter, for me, it's easy to go to a universalist perspective. It's not so easy if you're if you are suffering, if you're wanting God to do something to deal with those who oppress you. You want your oppressors to face some judgment and justice. And if, you know, you all get to go to the same place without any, you know, it's like there's no penalties here. That becomes a problem for many people. Not for me, but if you look at the book and the contributors were kind of, for the most part, white males. There's a few white females in the book. But I think if you look at folks that beyond our white liberal progressive community, there are some questions that get raised that maybe we're not ready to answer. So we can deconstruct hell, but maybe not get rid of it totally. I mean, I don't believe in hell, but I'm just saying.
No, I like that. And that's, you know, I think that's a really good place to end our conversation, just kind of like you did in the book. I think it challenges me on a regular basis to try to acknowledge those on the margins and how my theology is contextual, right? Because I can only be the person that I am, and I can only have the experiences that I have. And I can try to take into account other people's experiences, but I think that's a helpful and a beautiful kind of warning to just throwing things out, you know, for whatever good reasons we might have, just to say like, okay, well, maybe there are still some really helpful reasons that we should take into consideration.
Right. Now, and I understand that, and there's chapters in the book for people who, you know, grew up in very strong fundamentalist fire and brimstone backgrounds where the hell was scared out of them. For them, the idea is much more oppressive than it is for me, because I kind of let it go pretty easily because it wasn't very deeply ingrained. So I understand that my experience is different than some who wrote in the book for whom this is a kind of an existential issue in a different level than it is for the person who feels the need for judgment and justice on the oppressor. It's, I felt oppressed, and so I need to let this go. And so I know that there's both and so that's why I think the book allows us to have those conversations.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think that's one of my favorite things about the book is that it does bring together like different perspectives and offer that kind of conversation that I think needs to be had. This is not Josh's chapter episode, but I do like, I even within my chapter kind of talk about some of the like more problematic aspects towards like deconstruction, some of the things that we can fall into, but also at the same time say like, yeah, but also there's a whole bunch of stuff that really sucks and we do need to deconstruct those things. Right. And so like kind of, and I think that kind of encapsulates like the whole book. There's like this, this ongoing conversation. And I think that's what matters. I think the conversation is really important. And conversations like these, and also like, you know, you've alluded to listening to other people's stories and hearing for them for what they are and taking seriously their experience of, you know, how being an oppressive doctrine for them. And right. I'm with you. I lean towards universalism. So I'm like, yeah, get rid of it. But also trying to be balanced at the same time.
That's
so
right.
I appreciate your words and your wisdom in regards to that.
Some of this is rooted in my own years and years of pastoral engagement too. So, you know, dealing with, I've heard plenty of, I've heard a lot, plenty of people, preachers who use a funeral for a fire and brimstone a sermon. Don't think that works.
I agree. I've sat in my fair share of those.
Right.
But Oh, man. Well, Bob, this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you again for your contribution to Deconstructing Hell. Are there any other places aside from Deconstructing Hell that maybe you'd like to point listeners who are like, wow, Bob's work sounds really interesting, especially this Revelation stuff or, you know, whatever. Where might people go to connect with you or find your work?
So one would be our book, Second Thoughts About the Second Coming, which deals not just with Revelation, but the whole breadth of questions of eschatology. And it's written for a general audience. Greg Carey has written a book for Westminster John Knox that is really a great book. I'll just kind of plug it. It's a more scholarly book from Westminster John Knox that covers similar territory, but more focused on Bible. For me, I would say one place to go is I have a blog which I blog regularly at. It's Ponderings on a Faith Journey, but it's bobcornwall.com. That's an easy place to go. And you can also find me on Amazon and Goodreads. All my books are listed there. So I've written a lot of books that haven't sold. We think Second Thoughts About the Second Coming actually sold some copies. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, hopefully listeners go in and snag a copy of Second Thoughts on the Second Coming. Sounds like a fun conversation.
We'd love that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Bob, thank you again. And listeners, thanks so much for hanging out today and joining us on our journey of deconstructing hell. And as always, guys, go in peace.